here we are this evening, and the person who told me that they put this in there was going to be here tonight, and then he texted me this afternoon and said, found out that my birthday lunch isn't a birthday lunch after all. They've changed it to supper. So, Jim, this one's for you, even though you're not here. But the question or the topic was compare and discuss why there are so many big box churches, and at the same time, there seems to be a storefront church in strip malls and also in so many formerly abandoned buildings. That's a lot. That's a lot. So, anybody have any ideas?
Save money.
Yeah.
Do what?
Economical.
In the storefront, right?
Yeah. And if they fail, they move on without a loss, you know.
Without a big loss because they haven't built. Okay.
They'd have to be a bunch of churches splitting up, too, though.
Well, you do have churches that split, and these days they're not primarily Baptist, just primarily Baptist churches. Though, you know, Baptist, our math has always been we multiply by dividing. But well, the claim,
yeah,
the claim, especially the ones in storefronts and strip malls, they claim to be non-denominational, although typically they come out of a denominational setting, and even though they claim to be non-denominational, if you look at their whatever founding documents or whatever codes, creeds, beliefs, statements of belief, those kinds of things, they still reflect the majority of the denomination out of which they come.
More and more Hispanic churches opening up in this area.
Well, there are a lot. There's one not too far from us on State Park Road as well. So economics. Splits.
Have a disagreement.
Yeah.
Right.
And they will leave. They won't even have a preacher. They just have somebody to go.
Right.
Lead it.
Go lead it until they get them a preacher or whatever. And if they are of certain denominations, which also includes Baptists in general, but not all, it doesn't bother them if the person has no education. I did a little bit of surfing on the internet this afternoon, looking up a variety of folks. I already know that Perry Noble only had college and dropped out after one semester of seminary. No one on their staff has a seminary education. In fact, in all of their different little satellites, if you look at their staff, you'll find that one of them was just made a profession of faith and came to Christ in 2009 while he was in high school, and he's been going to church there and working somewhere else, and now he's heading up one of their sites as the site pastor. Clayton King, who has taken over, has a bachelor's degree from Gardner Webb, and I think he's currently working on a master of arts with missions emphasis, but not a master of divinity. Andy Stanley, Charles Stanley's son, he has an MA, a Master of Arts, from a seminary. Big Brother Joel Osteen dropped out of Oral Roberts University after one semester and never went back, went to work for his dad's church in direction and production, and now he heads it up. Not even college education. Do what? Yeah, well, he does. And, you know, that also seems to be something that is rather prevalent. Other ideas of where it comes from, why we end up with these, and then the big box churches, not just the storefront churches. Well, that's true. Folks who go can do whatever. We had a neighbor that got married a little over 2 weeks ago, and she and her husband got married at Downtown Presbyterian Church. Anybody know where Downtown Presbyterian Church is?
Downtown.
Yeah, it's downtown. It's right across from the water company. In a little building right across from the water company, I think a converted warehouse. And when we walked in the door, sure enough, right there was a barista stand. That wasn't open for the wedding, but right there was a barista stand. That, yeah, that's true. And I will say that, well, and I will say that the guy, although it's a Master of Arts in Religious Education, the guy at Marathon does have a degree from Southwestern Seminary, but it's an MA in Religious Education. But a lot of these don't. And typically Baptists, there were two strains of Baptists, by the way, on that. You had the Charleston tradition who wanted educated ministers. And then you had the Sandy Creek tradition who disliked and distrusted education. And more within Baptist life as a whole, more and more folks have gone toward the doesn't matter. I have heard folks say, well, you know, Jesus didn't have a seminary degree. Well, there's a little bit difference in, well, a lot of difference in Jesus and these guys. And seminary degree doesn't necessarily, it's not the end-all, beat-all in every case. I have known ministers who had very little education but were very effective, and they were preached very simply, but they were very good pastors in their ministry, and it wasn't as much about speaking, those kinds of things. So, you know, and there are others. I knew Joel didn't have any education. He just kind of inherited that. But a lot of others don't have that. Yes, Susan.
A lot of the revivalists that came around at the turn of the century, the, you know, the traveling
churches, right,
and the tents, not Billy Graham, but you know, the others.
Billy doesn't have that much education beyond honorary degrees.
Wheaton.
Right.
But were they educated, the ones that went to the tent revivalists, the ones that traveled?
Most were not. Now, some of the folks around, you know, that not so much the tent revivals, but came into your gymnasiums and auditoriums, a lot of those had at least some of that education.
But in Billy Graham's defense, he always encouraged people to join.
Oh, he did. Join a local church, join a local church.
And bring you the message of salvation.
Right.
But I insist that you go back and join the church and become part of my
tribe. Right. Well, you know, he gets some consideration there, yes.
Because some of the others don't make that
statement. No. But, you know, just trying to get y'all's ideas about some of this, I could give a variety of possibilities. And if you talk to especially millennials these days, it's interesting to hear their take on some of it. Some of the millennials really say that what they want is a church that is authentic. They've seen too much of the what they call the charlatan or the fake kind of stuff. They want a church that's authentic, whether it's got rah-rah Jesus music or whether it's got high church music. They want to see authenticity, authentic Christianity, not just for show and not just playing at religion and making it a country club or this is where I'm going to make my business contacts. So. Well, and there is a lot of that.
Sherry was about 13 years old. She started questioning our doctrine and everything else. She didn't like that. She didn't like that. Why don't they have this? And I said, well, you need to start Sherryism.
Well, and you know, but that is kind of true, Ed. In fact, the scripture passage that I'm going to jump to in a little bit is in 2 Timothy 4. And verses 3 and 4 say, although we'll go into that before and after as well, but verses 3, for the time is coming. But it wasn't just coming when this was written, it was also present then. When people will not endure sound teaching, but having itching ears, they will accumulate for themselves teachers to suit their own likings, will turn away from listening to the truth and wander into myths. So even back in the first century, you had with all the different religions around and everything else, and you had that going on. But some of the say, well, we are doing this, we're going to these churches, we're starting these churches because we think that the church as a whole has been rather inauthentic. And, you know, I get another way of saying that is, I get folks saying, well, you know, I don't go because it's only full of a bunch of hypocrites. And my response is, well, what better place for hypocrites to be? than in the church. But if you're not going to come because there's a bunch of hypocrites, you might want to look at the fingers pointing back at you when you point at them. But, you know, they want to see that authenticity, and they don't want to see people that just show up for Christmas, Easter, funerals, and weddings. And they want to see it not just at church, they want to see it lived out in your life, recognizing that you're not perfect, but you go to church as well. So they want the full package. And that's what they mean by that authenticity. Whether it's high church, low church, whatever. Some have said that they want the church to address questions that they have, and churches are uncomfortable addressing questions. Questions about, you know, religious questions, social questions, ethical issues, those kinds of things. And they don't want quick, easy, pat answers. Those who are looking for that authenticity, and churches that will ask questions. And so if they can't find that, then they find somebody that will do it and start one. And then you get those, what I call the easy religion. And quite frankly, while Campus Crusade and Young Life and some other things like that have done some good, they've also fed into that kind of quick, easy religion over the decades as well. Primarily because of a lot of the leadership that got put in to those kinds of things. They don't want to have to think or learn. So they find a church where about the deeper sense of the Bible or religion or doctrine. So they find a church that where somebody tells them what to do, what to think, and let them get on with their life. Some are looking for, some of these churches, social issues. Not just individuals, but there are churches that jump out there based almost totally on social issues and how the Bible relates to some of those. Churches, they want the churches to get outside the walls and do things, but most of them want them to be socially acceptable and agree with their particular viewpoint, not. So once again, Ed, looking for something. Y'all mentioned religiotainment or entertainment, religiotainment. They don't want you to talk holy language. And people don't want to learn the religious language. They want their folks, and some of this has been conducted in surveys, and quite frankly, I've run into a lot of it over the years just with a variety of people. Want you to talk like the average person on the street, in the alley, at a party. And then I said, speaking of parties, let's sing and sway and feel like we're having a party. A lot of these kinds of places and attract folks, they're built like, I didn't read this anywhere, so you can only blame me if you don't like the terminology. It's built and operated like a perpetual youth group. 50 years old and it's still a perpetual youth group. Never get out of that. And so people do look for those kinds of things. Andy Stanley mentioned him a while ago. Not just with the religiotainment, but also there's more for some, and I hear from some folks, there's more to do at the big box church because there's more kids there and they got a bigger budget. Andy Stanley kind of created a stir last year, or several months ago, when he preached a sermon and he said that you are a bad parent if you take your children to a small church. If you really cared about them and you were a good parent, you would bring them to big churches where they could have lots of friends, a lot of activities, and big activities. He didn't. Where you can actually serve, right? Well, and that's the thing. He caught a bunch of flack for that, and then he tried to back up and say, well, but if you really think about it logically, you've got more opportunities for your children if you go to the big church. But if you choose to go to the other one, well, it's not necessarily that you're a bad parent, but you may not be looking out for the best interests of your children. Well, that's just a backhanded way of saying, in his opinion, you're a bad parent. But they don't look for the service.
Yeah.
Oh, no. No, not at all.
I don't mean it that way. But some of these churches, it's just about keeping the children in the faith.
Well, that's very true. And we've got a lot of those in South Carolina and in North Carolina and all around. Well, oh no! If they have to be older than 12, over 12, it is. But there's a separate building for them until they're over 12. In a lot of them. Well, and that's a big part. That's a big part of it. In fact, there, several months ago, I was on one Friday. I was flipping some channels, and they were talking on one of the news channels, and I can't remember the woman's name. She's pretty much dressed in all black lipstick and all. Gothic kind of stuff, spiked hair, and she is pastoring a church, but she talks, and they were talking about how, you know, the people that come there, a lot of them are, you know, they're off the streets and everything, so she talks their language, but as one person said, no sailor could turn the air as blue as she does from her pulpit. That's not elevating the life of the person. That's getting down into the gutter. Yes.
They said some churches got this done over the 12 in the sanctuary. What about these churches, maybe some of the bigger churches nowadays, baptizing these kids 3, 4, 5 years old?
Well, a lot of that's about numbers. Just like the multiple baptisms. You know, people in Anderson. Our daughter-in-law's sister has been baptized at least 3 times, once at Boulevard and twice at the Big Box Church.
I was saved again.
Yes. Yes. Others get those kinds of things. And it's about numbers, making people feel guilty, so that you can say, not that we've rebaptized 3/4 of the ones that we're counting, but look at all the people we baptized.
No. I've been very reluctant to respond to that because, you know, you don't want to create problems with other people.
But no, you don't.
Philosophically and theologically, how would you respond to that as a pastor of someone that was just as long as my children are attending church somewhere?
Well, I get that sometimes.
I'm really happy that they're in church and praising Jesus. If they're there, they're not, you know.
Yeah, if they're there, they're not out doing something else.
Right.
Well, there are a couple of ways, and I've used a couple of different approaches before, talking about study to show yourself approved. That doesn't mean just when you're old, in Timothy. Jesus saying that you love God with your heart and with your soul and with your mind and with your strength. And while it needs to be, they need to be learning those things that will... Proverbs, train up a child in the way that they should go. Deuteronomy, teach these things to your children. Talk about them in the market and at home and teach them to your children and your children's children. And I think a lot of I don't care as long as they're in church and they're not somewhere else is also, are those parents the ones that are doing the teaching? Or have we, like with public education, the teachers teach, now we're pushing this off and whatever, as long as they're around Christian kids. Well, you know, PKs can be some of the worst kids out there. And it is a tough line. You don't want to judge, but I also ask, okay, what are they learning? That's the thing. What are they learning? How are they learning and what are they learning? And is it something that is theologically sound or not? And, you know, we're not supposed to just, and, you know, there are people who for various reasons cannot ever get mentally beyond a certain level anyway. We know, you know, children, certain diseases, other kinds of things. But even they can learn more than what we often think. Why should we think that we're any less responsible for learning and for passing on that learning? So I try to ask people, okay, well, what are they learning? What are some of the basic doctrines? What are the teachings? Where are they coming from? And does it really relate to a deeper spirituality and life? Or is it something just, well, they're there, they enjoy it, and so as long as they're there and they enjoy it, then that's okay because they're in a church. We have put forth, let's see, how am I going to put this? Many of us, even in my vocation, have put forth the idea for a long, 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 long time, all the way back, even Middle Ages and before. That if we get them in the door and if we get them baptized, they got their ticket to ride. And they're covered. In the early church, you didn't get that ticket to ride you didn't get baptized for a year most of the time. And in a lot of the early church, baptism took place once a year, and that was at Easter. And before that, you had to learn and you had to prove that you understood what you were doing. And you had to prove that you understood the basic teachings and how they were to be applied before you were allowed to be baptized. So I try to approach it from the position, okay, what are they learning theologically? What are the foundations? And then what are they building? If all they're doing is keep laying the foundation over and over and over again, and they never build anything more on it, they're not going to be. When difficult times come, the platitudes aren't going to work. But I try to do it in a non-judgmental fashion, which sometimes can be tough if they come back at you with a snooty attitude. Back to the young ones, that's why I meet with people here. And there have been some times in the 13 years I've been here that I talked to the parents afterwards or the grandparents and said, this child's not quite ready yet. Keep working on it. Keep letting them ask the questions. Keep talking about it. But they're not ready yet. And that's been 5 years old and 13 years old.
I agree with that. I just don't keep seeing somebody 4 or 5 years old.
But we have, and I kind of chased my own rabbit off somewhere a minute ago. But part of that is people in my vocation have also made baptism so important with that ticket to ride that they're wanting to baptize as many as they can and whoever they can. And to give that hope to the parents and the grandparents and the other folks. Well, this person, they're now one of God's children. That's not saying they can't be. But I think God expects a little more of us than that, too. And sometimes we push that too much. I think many are. I think some could be called, could have at their root religious connotations, but many of them water down, and it's more about, well, I go to this, and I go to this big box church, whether it's the multiple campuses or whether it's a mega church with a big name. There are folks that go to those things to get lost. That's another thing. They don't, you ask the service question, they want to get lost. They don't want people to miss them if they're not there. So it's really, it's almost like a hydra to try and to put this all together. Another thing that's, another reason that I think a lot of this has happened as well is, and this is where I got into earlier talking about, and I looked up a number of folks, and their educational backgrounds. Typically, and I'm not sure that's the case right now, but up until a few years ago, there were more people in seminaries in the United States than there were churches for those folks. More people in seminaries. And in college, preparing with religion degrees to go to seminary than there were churches for them to come into. When I came through and I got my MDiv and then my THM in New Testament, there were a lot of folks that got an MRE, Master of Religious Education. They wanted to be youth people. I know of one whose son worked here for a while. In fact, I was in seminary with Ron, who got an MRE, and he has been a youth minister for all of his career, who in the last few years has been trying to move into the pastorate, and that MRE is holding him back instead of an MDiv. Because that was his focus, was, you know, he didn't get any of the pastoral stuff or any of that. It was on being religious education and a youth minister.
And I think, wasn't First Baptist in Greenville at one time, they had like 8 or so, they weren't all pastors, but they all had some degree of,
yes,
religious education. Yes.
Yes.
Three
or four years ago. Well, and there were some other things that went into that. I know some of the backstories, but yes.
They had a huge staff.
Huge staff, all, most of whom had master's degrees.
Some had more.
And some more. And and so, yes, they did some cutting, but then adding others later and that kind of stuff. But there, with that and all those people in college and seminary, then there are churches, then the emphasis became, well, just go out and plant your own church. Be a church planter. And there are movements, even within denominations, where they train people to plant churches. And then there are others who say, well, I really didn't like this church, and when I was in school, I worked at this church and didn't really like that. I didn't agree with that, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go out here and start one. Basically, what I call it, you create the church in your own image.
That's what I'm thinking. When I scan through the TV and what I've heard here, it seems to me like they're appealing to the desires, not the needs.
Yes.
And it's almost like that's entertainment. There's no business like show business and anything else. And that's, yeah, this is
well, and a lot of them have decided, and the largest one, and they always refer to it as the largest and richest in South Carolina, started out bringing in college and high school kids, and that's their major focus. We can get the college and high school kids here, most of whom can't pay the bills, but their parents were brought up believing that the whole family should go to church together. And so then the parents eventually come over when the kids won't come back, and then the parents pay the bills, which is kind of coming in the back door or maybe up from the basement. I don't know. But that's true. And in 2 Timothy chapter 4, Paul begins, "I charge you in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who is to judge the living and the dead, and by his appearing and his kingdom." Then he gives 9, 5 of which are in verse 2, and the other 4 are in verse 5. He gives 9 imperatives as to what should happen. What should happen? First, preach the word. Verse 2. That's kind of shorthand for the Christian message, that is, the words of faith. Two, be urgent. Literally, it means be ready. And my translation says be urgent in the season and out of season, but actually the Greek words say be urgent or be ready in well-timely and untimely. In and out of season, when things are good and when things are not, whether it's favorable or not. The third, he says, is convince. Convince people. That is, help keep them from error, whether intellectually, morally, or spiritually, but you do it by convincing them, not by entertaining or beating them over the head or whatever. Rebuke. Now, you know, and rebuke here, we think we've got our finger wagging and somebody says, no. Rebuke in early sense in the New Testament meant to warn people of error. To warn them of error. Now, you might have to get in their face sometime, depending on how they are and what their errors are, but it also means as you preach the word and as you convince people, you also warn them of errors that are taking place. And encourage, he says, rebuke and exhort, which is encourage. And then it says, be unfailing in patience and in teaching. Well, actually, that's not a separate one. That goes along with all of these. We're to do all of this, to encourage people to live appropriate to their calling as Christians. And all of this is to be, literally the Greek text says, would say exhort or encourage in all patience and teaching. And I could tell you that's called a hendiadys, which means you have two words that are connected by and one modifies the other or explains the other. And in this case, the primary one is teaching, and teaching is characterized by patience. Patient teaching is what it could say. Exhort or encourage with patient teaching. And Timothy had seen how Paul had been patient, although he wasn't always patient, right? Paul had been more patient with him than he was with Mark. But he says with patient teaching. But then it comes to verses 3 and 4, which are where I was getting to earlier, Ed, with the scripture, where he says, for the time is coming when people will not endure sound teaching, but having itching ears, they will accumulate for themselves teachers to suit their own likings and will turn away from listening to the truth and wander into myths. He's already said earlier, in the writer has said in 1 Timothy and earlier in 2 Timothy, he's talked about false teachers who prey on the gullible. P.T. Barnum. Yeah. The gullible.
Yeah.
Well, and it's hard to do because they do. They look back, and these days. Right. Well, who died and left you boss? You know, that kind of thing. Or these days, you never know. They're liable to haul off. You know, because the sense of respect for persons, they're liable to either, at the very least, turn the air blue, cussing you out, and it might even do worse, physical harm. So that's really, I think you have to pick that carefully and pick your words carefully and hope that they don't react that way. But it's difficult. What I do sometimes with folks, and I've had it happen in a number of cases, but they'll be taught, I'll say, really? Oh, yeah, what do you think? I'll say, but I only do that to people that I don't think are bigger than me, going to beat me up. But you know, you have to be careful, you know, with that, because it's supposed to be with patience. But you know, sometimes we run out of that. But the emphasis here is on the people who are looking for that. Earlier, he talked about the false teachers who prey on gullible people. Now he's talking about the people who go looking for that. And I think that's one of the things with the proliferation of this. You've got, on the one hand, you've got people that are not necessarily always the false teachers, but they're looking to make a name. And on the other side, you got the people that are running around with the tray in a cafeteria looking for something they like. And so he says, you know, those who will be led astray, that's the emphasis here. And will not put up with sound doctrine. Literally, the Greek reads, they will not accept, receive, and listen to sound teaching. He uses two metaphors here, which I think are really appropriate even for our time and all of this, these things coming along. The first one is people who have itching ears. That was a metaphor. That was an idiom that was always describing people who were listening for spicy bits of information. As one commentator wrote, and I quote, "People will follow their own whims and passions, catering to their own selfish interests rather than sound teaching that faithful teachers offer. To scratch their ears, therefore, they will accumulate their own teachers to suit their own desires. They will seek out teachers who will tickle their ears and suit their fancies, moving from teacher to teacher to teacher until they find the teacher who says what they want to hear." Here, we used to call that church hopping. That's Watson Mills, who worked and taught at Mercer. So that's one metaphor. Those who are, until they find something that scratches their itch and calms them down. Yeah, it's kind of like sometimes I can't reach and I'll go ahead, you know, scratch yourself. And I think of Baloo the bear when you go up against a tree or the door facing. But, you know, once you get that itch scratched and taken care of, hey, you're fine. Well, that's what they're looking for with that. With religion. The other metaphor he uses, they will turn away from listening to the truth and wander into myths. Truth in the pastoral epistles, which this is one of, they're called the pastorals. Truth in here is the gospel message. The gospel message about, and not just the gospel message about Jesus, but the gospel message as in what Jesus taught as well. So it's not just the message about Jesus, though that is important and foundational. It also includes what Jesus himself taught. Which, once again, I go back to. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. Myths, the only place myth is mentioned in the New Testament is in these letters. Myth was kind of the equivalent of old wives' tales. Or fanciful imaginations. That were paraded around as truth. In fact, there were Epictetus, I believe it was, raised questions about to some folks about whether they really believed that Homer's fanciful writings were the truth or not, because there were people who thought the Iliad and the Odyssey, oh, well, that's gospel truth, or like gospel truth, instead of Homer's fanciful writings about some of these things. And so there are people who do that. In fact, the word cafeteria or consumer churches have been bandied around for probably 20 years or more now to describe the changeover from staying with this and slowly learning and building to, well, you know, I really didn't like that, so I'm going to go over here and see what this one's like. Well, nah. I'm going to go over here, just like in the cafeteria, you may decide, and I won't, so don't worry. I'll leave plenty for you. In the cafeteria, you may pick up the liver and onions. I'm not going to. If the roast beef is rare enough to moo at you, then I might get that. Or I might get the pot pie if it looks really good or whatever, but we pick what we like. You might like liver and onions. I've never eaten liver mush either, but it doesn't sound right. It's that cafeteria approach to religion as well. And another part of all of these churches springing up is to try and capture what somebody's looking for at this moment in time. Yes, Susan.
Well, you know, a lot of younger people are quick to point out corruption in established religion, like Catholic priest thing that was terrible.
Right.
But they won't put the same glasses on to look within theirs and ask right. The questions.
Right.
How is our money being spent? What's
right.
Happening within our congregation? Is there anyone who would look at our church to say, we might have something going on here you hear over and over things that aren't necessarily in established religions, but
right.
Even some of these new churches, things happen.
Right. Oh, they do. And, that's one of the things with just go ahead and call it out, with New Spring is you cannot. With their budget, they'll tell you how much it took in. They'll say it was all spent on missions, which includes the staff. But you can't. Well, you can find out what some of the secretarial staff might make. You can't find out what any of the ministers on staff make.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And what they had contributed.
Right.
And when you got to New Spring, it was blank all the way across.
I know the rumor out there was several hundred thousand dollars for Perry, but see, the church didn't set his salary either. Yes. Yes. Actually, he and Stephen Furtick and some of these at Elevation Church in Charlotte and some of these other big mega church guys were part of a group. And the group decided what each one was going to make, and they told the church what they thought they were worth. The group told the church, this is what you ought to pay.
Perry no longer can go behind the pulpit, whatever. But I guess he's probably still coming in since he's one regional.
Well, I don't know, and I won't be surprised even if another shoe drops if somewhere down the road he doesn't show back up.
Yeah.
But then again, look at Jim. Not you, and not this one, but Jim Baker, who dropped out and then came back, or the other Jim, known as Jimmy, who dropped out and then, well, he never did drop out. He never gave up. He refused. But, yeah. So, you know, so this is not an easy thing to talk about or to, I don't know about solving. Watson Mills writes, with the proliferation of religion and spirituality in bookstores, movies, TV, and the internet, it's clear that people today have itching ears. There is no shortage of teachers willing to scratch that itch. Postmodern thought encourages people to make room for more spiritual possibilities than many are willing to accommodate. So they get attacked. And then he says, traditional Christianity is but one way among many. Each must find their own truth. These are the prevailing mantras of postmodernism. We must have a more generous orthodoxy. Maybe in some things, but it's necessary to have some form of acceptable orthodoxy before we can be generous about it. Right.
Kind of sermon, as opposed to just a traditional, say, teaching sermon where you're coming up with something theological.
And that takes a whole lot of work, too. But yes.
Emotionally,
yes.
No. I'm just saying, there comes to a creative point at which he's got to be absolutely wiped out. Because those kind of things are dramatic.
Right.
You know, the magician like David Copperfield, he takes a show on the road. That's one whole year.
Mm-hmm.
Every new place is the same road. Or,
right.
You know, any number of comedians. I was shocked when I went to see some comedians, and I found out exactly, like Jerry Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
He does the same show everywhere he goes. It's
right.
The same material. But when you have a location and you're trying to keep people entertained and come up with a new shtick every week, it's got to be so you can go out and then resurface.
Right. Well.
Because it's more of a shtick or feel.
And back to your other, you know, some of the topics that they have, especially marital topics that they have, and a few years ago where he and even some of the 13, 14-year-olds were not allowed in on this one particular service because he and his wife were wheeled out in a bed, and from the bed in their pajamas he talked about sexual relationships and marriage and that kind of stuff. So, you know, but once again, you've got it in other places too, and people do get jaded because they read and hear what goes on with the priests, or they read and hear about the guy that runs off with the secretary, or the former pastor, one of the former pastors of First Baptist Church running off with the minister of youth wife.
I felt the old-time Baptist religion, like preachers say, do what I say, don't do what I do.
Well, that's what the Pharisees said. Jesus warned about that in Matthew, and he said, don't do, you know, they bind heavy burdens, you know, said, do what they say, but don't do what they do because they won't lift a finger to do it. Tent revivals, the old sawdust trail.
In fact, there's one on 123. It reminded me, I don't know, I guess maybe it was the title or something. Has anybody saw it? It was like Dr. Stevens and something. Kind of reminded me of it, like in the traveling show or something. But there was empty.
Neil Diamond song.
There, and then when I was leaving from work, it looked like it was kind of over. And I'm like, well, why would you do that during the day and not in the evening?
Well, I think they're trying to attract people that are retired and people that, you know, normally would not, you know, or maybe people that work another shift. Brother Love's Traveling Salvation Show, Neil Diamond. Yeah, well, Elma Gantry, those kinds of things. Where was I recently? I was somewhere recently and talking, or it might have been when my sister-in-law's father died, and I rode up on a Monday and for the visitation and back that night and talking to somebody that was there, and he gave me his card, which on my way out found its way into a cylinder, he does that, and their revival, tent revival on the side of I-85 right outside of Burlington, North Carolina, had been going great guns for 10 weeks. And they were hoping to come to South Carolina, and if I knew the places that they could be in South Carolina. But
right. Where I work, there's a little place, a big empty space between Freeman Gas and some type of body shop or something, and it's just empty, and they were just sit out there, big old thing. I couldn't figure out what they're
doing.
Don't you think sometimes somebody had changed church and become a member of certain church, hoping they'd be able to get the stitch inside the church and follow them back and be able to correct on church too. You know, we had issues here of people trying to talk about religion and all that not long back. You know, it's almost like you went in there for just one reason to try to stir up problems and
this, you know. There is some of that that takes place. And then you got, you know, money people and all kinds of things. But it's, you know, this is not something that's going to be solved. May not even be solved in my lifetime. But it is a topic that's going to keep going. It's been going on for a long time in the church. But the question was, why? I think there are a lot of reasons why. And some of them are more excuses why instead of reasons why. But I think the thing that is incumbent upon each of us is that we continue to study and learn individually and corporately so that we can know what, why, and even let folks know. And one of the ways that we learn is, unfortunately sometimes, is by dealing with uncomfortable questions. And by digging deeper. And this is a dollar gets you drink machine, but y'all already know that I'm a firm believer that if we are not good stewards of the minds with which God gave us to think and reason and learn and find out more about God and with each other, we really can't be good stewards of anything else. Time, efforts, talents, money, any of that stuff. But I do think, especially with the way the world is, it's always been this way to a certain degree, but the way the world is today and it's so helter-skelter and fast-paced that a lot of folks are looking for a place where they can find some entertainment, some lightheartedness maybe, but they can also be told, this is what you ought to believe. Now you can get on out of here and do whatever. And when we make it too simple and nothing but the same thing every time, just the 4-point, 3-point, 4-point, 8-point plan of salvation or whatever, then we're not feeding people meat, but milk. And there's not a one of us in here that would be, although I, that wedding reception yesterday, I didn't need to eat 8 chicken tenders that were about this big, but I was hungry, and they were good. They were good. So, you know, sometimes we need to practice pushaways. But none of us would be where we are or how we are if all we did was drink milk.
Yes, sir. Or eat dessert.
Or eat, no, that's right. That's right. Oh yes, he said. Well, and he said also to one of the churches. He said, "You know, you folks, you're on milk. You need to be moving on to the meat." And then you got. I bet you got a picture of him up then, and you throw your darts. So anyway, it's not an easy thing to answer, and it's something that's. I think is going to be troubling. It has been in the past. I think it's going to continue to be troubling for a lot of folks who see the church as something more important and with more depth. But anyway, now we didn't solve it. But thank you all for your discussion, for your input. God bless you and go in peace, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.